everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two lovely sponsors for you at the top here. Environments for Humans are promoting their RWD Summit, Responsive Web Design Summit. That's rwdsummit.com. 3 days coming up, March 11th through 12th. If you'd like to go to that, use coupon code SHOPTALK for 20% off. And LYNDA.com/shoptalk is a 10-day free trial. They've just extended it a little bit. It's a huge learning resource on the web. Check that out. We're going to tell you more about both those things later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off.
Shopper Maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, podcast all about front-end web design, development, Jorba Scrumps, all those things that you use on a day-to-day basis. I'm Dave Rupin. With me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, everybody. And with us, we have Mr. Tom Dale. Hey, Tom.
Hey, guys. I can't believe you got the rights to the Firefly theme song for your podcast.
No, the Firefly theme song has this cool acoustic guitar, and it's like... Ain't nobody out in the west.
Whoa. I thought you had it for a really minute, but weird. Then you went off the rails there. It's, you can't take the sky from me. Come on. With the like little dun-dun banjo thing in it. Yeah. It's close, though. Tom Dale, man of few letters.
Chris, can't take me off the rails?
Hey.
Is that a segue?
That was okay.
Went off the rails.
Tom,
the funny thing is, I never wrote any Rails apps, really. Yeah, people think I'm a big Rails guy, but I just like the ideas. But I don't actually, I couldn't write Ruby to save my life. That's not entirely true, but it's 98% true.
That's interesting. So you didn't, you weren't like a Rails core team member or anything?
No,
like that,
I haven't really been programming for that long, to be honest with you. I wasn't actually programming long enough to have been an early Rails contributor.
That's interesting. But people associate that because you're associated with Yehuda, and Yehuda is a Rails.
Also, I just take all of DHH's good ideas and I repeat them as though they're my own in the JavaScript context. Mm. So that's why people associate me with it.
I see. Yeah.
But, yeah.
That's cool. And it's related to, I don't know, like if you go to tilde.io, right? Is it, did I get it right?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
I need to go there because I want to look at it. There's logos. There's your beautiful team, Tom and Plaid, Yehuda and Leia.
Well, yeah, but the thing you have to keep in mind is that Yehuda has written half the internet. So anything that he's touched, we're going to put on there for promotion.
Did they put him in the middle on purpose then in the show?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think if you think about it, I feel like on a day-to-day basis, the majority of the world runs software that Yehuda wrote. If you think about it, like if you think about jQuery, Rails, Ember, and especially if you take into account like the standards work, I'm a huge fanboy. It's actually really cool to work with someone that you're a fanboy of.
Yeah, that's awesome. What a nice thing to say. And so, and the thing that you work the most on, that's also a part of Tilde, and is probably what most people know you possibly from that are listening to this show, is Ember. So I thought we would ask you Ember questions and talk about Ember a bunch and talk about new things happening with Ember and stuff. Do you have any kind of like intro for us for that, or are you, do you want to maybe
intro,
I don't know, maybe
for even... Ember? Well, I would say that obviously Ember is the best technology ever written. If you're not using it, you're probably doing something wrong. Literally any problems that you're having right now, like think about the code you're writing right now, probably all those problems and frustrations you're having right now would be solved if you used Ember.
Can it do like division?
It can do division, not by zero, where that's in version 3. It can julienne fries, however.
Good.
This is great. So it does, it's so... Ember is node bots for the cloud.
Well, it is enterprise ready. It actually is used in the enterprise, I have to say. So the thing I think about Ember is obviously a JavaScript framework. Probably everyone listening knows that Ember is a JavaScript framework. But the big difference between Ember and most other tools is that we're not really designed to be sprinkled on top of an existing server rendered app. The whole point of Ember is to bring an architecture. Like, think about using native apps on a mobile device, like on iOS or on Android, and how fast and how responsive they feel. And you can do get that kind of responsiveness because all of the rendering and all of the decision-making is happening on the client, on your phone, and then that phone is just talking to an API somewhere. And so Ember is all about bringing that exact same architectural model to the web, where your website is literally just another client of the API, like your iOS app, like your Android app, except it still feels webby. It doesn't feel like a native app. We're not going for like Sprout Core or Cappuccino were the two major projects that tried to accomplish this native look and feel. Mm-hmm. We don't care about native look and feel so much. We care about this architecture, basically. The architecture buys you the speed, okay. I think. But more than that, I think the biggest thing that I want to kill is complexity. Like, developers spend so much time just battling with complexity and solving the same problems over and over again. And having this architecture, you have to have an API anyway for your mobile apps. Making your website just a client actually dramatically simplifies the architecture.
So, okay, that's an interesting one. Because even me and Dave were talking about last night. I'd be like, oh, it's going to be fun tomorrow. It's going to be another show. We're going to talk a lot about JavaScript architecture stuff. And we're kind of like, this would be interesting to get, super core person like you to kind of get us in and sell us on the idea. Because I don't think me and Dave, either of us have really we've certainly never built like a full Ember app or anything or really used any of these in a big way. So as somebody who I work on apps that largely do server side rendering, and then we use like jQuery to, and pull the bits that we need and stuff sell us on that idea. Maybe it's kind of rewrite territory if we were to.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is. Yeah. I think, I don't know about if it's rewrite territory, but it's definitely like greenfield territory, but you can start to migrate over page by page. Mm-hmm. It's not like you have to drop everything that you have and start over, but you do have to kind of start, we're going to redo this page as an Ember app, let's say.
Yeah.
But I think the thing to keep in mind is everyone who has a mobile app has to have a JSON API, right? Like, imagine using a native app where every transition where it slid from one side of the screen to the other, all of that was instructions coming from the server. That would feel terrible, right? But when it comes to writing websites, we're totally okay with that model. Where I think the analogy that Trek, a fellow team core team member, used was basically for the last couple of years, with every interaction on the web, there've been two supercomputers involved: the supercomputer sitting right in front of you, and the supercomputer in a data center somewhere in West Virginia. And that supercomputer sitting in front of you, we have not begun to take advantage of.
Right. It's just capable of way more than what a browser is doing.
Yeah, it's so much faster. Like, you can deliver interactions that you couldn't deliver if you have this minimum latency of, let's say, 50 to 100 milliseconds, probably more. That 50 to 100 milliseconds is, a best case scenario. So people have discovered that, and that's why you start to use jQuery, right? Like, what are the times when you would add jQuery to a server rendered site?
Yep. When you would add to a rendered site?
Yeah, when do you feel like I should add jQuery to the site?
Well,
what are the times of things you use jQuery for?
The classic things, DOM and AJAX.
Right, because basically what you want to happen is that when the user clicks a button, boom, the page responds instantly, right? You want to show a loading spinner, which is the classic case.
Sure.
But what if every single navigation, what if every single action on the page felt that fast and that good? And that's what you get when you move the entire logic of the application away from this supercomputer sitting in a data center. And by the way, an iPhone 6 is more powerful than whatever micro instance you have in AWS. I'll just throw that in there for the record. You have this computer that's actually more powerful than your server sitting right there, plugged into the glass that the user is looking at. And by moving the logic from the server there, you can make every aspect of the interaction that fast. Everything, the quickness of the interaction that you get with jQuery, imagine if everything was that fast, including navigation.
Because it has the template in it. It has everything but the data, right?
It has everything but the data, but oftentimes it has the data too. This is the thing that I think people maybe don't understand, is that if I am viewing some data like an email, that email doesn't change. It's immutable, right? So if I leave the page, but then I come back, that email was just in memory a few seconds ago. Why shouldn't I keep it in, you know, keep it in memory and then just display it without having to fetch it across the network again? If you think about your native apps, like your email app on your phone, or if you think about the Twitter app on Android or iOS, it works the exact same way. It caches the data and then it just confers with the server only to get updates.
And you maybe got to that email from a list of emails, and when you go back to that list of emails, that's already there in data as well, I suppose.
Right. And 9 times out of 10, that list isn't changing. So when you go back, you can show the data that you had a second ago, and then you can go say, hey, are there any new ones? And when they come in, you can insert it. But you can have just a much, much better experience. And I think the other thing, too, is just that it's a lot simpler. Conceptually, the model is simpler. Your servers, when you're building your website as just a client of an API, become dramatically simpler. You know, every good engineer that you talk to will say, of course, you should separate concerns. I don't think that's a controversial statement. But at the same time, people who advocate for server-rendered web apps are basically saying, I want to conflate view rendering and data access and authorization into the same software stack.
Yeah.
To me, the UI and the data access are two totally separate things, and there's a lot of benefit in terms of reducing complexity and separating them, even having separate teams working on them if you're at a big enough company.
So that's what Ember does, is that it might manage that kind of what is it hanging on to data-wise, and what is it going to get rid of, because that's getting a little too much, right? You can't. There's probably apps out there that there's just too much data to hold on to practically for memory reasons and stuff. Is that the kind of thing?
And we let you manage that. Basically, the data layer in Ember is very abstract. So the way that you start is you just do like $.ajax to go fetch data. And then there are several different data persistence libraries that try to be more like an ORM. So the one that I work on is called Ember Data. And that's really nice if you have a very conventional API. Like, let's say that you're using a backend like Firebase or Hoodie or something like that. You know, you can just install our JavaScript library and not have to write any network code at all, which is really nice. But yeah, I mean, there are considerations when you're getting into very large data sets. But in practice, I think most people are just doing pretty simple CRUD apps.
Yeah, I am attracted to that idea, right? That, in a traditional setup, we might be like, okay, I know this is what the data looks like, so I have to write some back-end stuff to make sure that it's coming at me just as I expect it. Then I need to write front-end code that's $.ajax-y that is going to go get it. And then I need to write stuff that's like, okay, now that I got it, what am I going to do with it? Am I going to template it, or do I not even need to because I can just drop it into stuff that's already on the page? There's a lot of thinking about it. And then let's say it changes on the page. I need to save it. I need to write that stuff in reverse to get there. That is attractive to know that it's just like I can just kind of make this like model of data, and it just kind of knows what to do on both sides.
Yeah, and I think the most important thing is that people who are used to a server rendered environment are used to extremely mature software stacks. So I know a lot of people who are Rails developers who heard the hype about, you know, JavaScript and client side apps, and they were like, oh, let's go check this out and see what this is all about. And they go from this very mature stack to the JavaScript ecosystem, which especially a year or two ago was extremely immature. There was no kind of off-the-shelf stack that you could download and install. It was like, you know, here's 1,000 different modules. Here's 1,000 different templating systems. Here's 1,000 different data layers. So go have fun putting them together. And I think what Ember tries to do is be a little bit more opinionated and say, hey, we have a big team of people. We have a big community of people using this in production. These are the things that we think are the best way to build web applications today. And we have an off-the-shelf stack that you can pull down. You can replace bits if you don't like a particular decision that we made, because it's all modular, but we have kind of a standard stack that people can pull down. So that level of opinion and basically providing the full picture so you don't spend weeks and weeks arguing over the minutia is, I think, one of the key advantages of Ember over other frameworks in the ecosystem.
Great. Yeah, I think we'll spend a little bit more time on that in a minute, kind of the, but I, we got a, that was a good intro to it. And kind of, you're going to, I don't know, get more with Ember, right? It's not a sprinkle inner, as you said. It's kind of provides more. Let's wait for a question to get up with that. But yeah, anything else we should know about Tom, Portland?
Oh, Tilda. Loving it.
Are you really? Are you newish to Portland?
Yeah, I'm new. I moved in January. Yeah, so I've only been here just about a year. It's great. I mean, the weather's kind of not great right now. But honestly, you know, I grew up in California. So really, do you want the weather to be so good 24 hours a day, 365 days per year, you know? Can you be happy when the weather is just perfect all the time?
I have an answer to that. No.
The answer is yes, you absolutely can be.
It bothers me. I was glad to leave it. Like, it's dreary and gross right now, and I live in Wisconsin, and I don't mind. Just because this is where I grew up, so I guess it kind of feels like what I'm used to. But
like home. Yeah.
Every day has its own flavor.
I lived in Los Angeles for 2 years, and I didn't see a single cloud, and it messes with you, man. Didn't see a cloud for 2 years. It was wild.
Well, that's not the weather. That's just the smog obscuring the sky.
Yeah, there was a haze. Yeah. There was haze, varying degrees of haze, but it was wild. You never saw a thundercloud or anything.
No, I love Portland, man. The coffee is awesome here. The beer is good. The food is good.
Which quadrant?
Everyone's like mellow. I'm in Northwest, which is like mini San Francisco now. Literally, I moved into my apartment building, and on the second day I was here, I saw a kid in a GitHub onesie. Like, this is San Francisco mini up here.
Got a little techie. Yeah, I used to live there for a couple years. I miss it. I was Northeast, though. Let's see. Let's get some questions. How about that? We have one from Andreas Nevin, who says, I'm not so experienced with JavaScript, so I really don't quite understand the potential benefits from using a JavaScript front-end framework. Could you describe it with your own words and give some examples for real-world use cases? So I thought we would just softball you this one, kind of be like, okay, Ember's a thing. We've already kind of made the case for it, but maybe how about some real-world examples?
Yeah, well, there's a ton, and this is what's been really awesome for me, you know, working on open source. You toil away for a long time, and for a very long time, you don't really have any adopters. You're kind of just doing it for yourself, and so you wonder if you're just crazy. But there are several big production users of Ember. Square is one. And actually, what I'll recommend to everyone listening at home is if you go on to the Chrome Store, or if you go to the Mozilla add-ons marketplace, or whatever they call it, you can install the Ember Inspector, which is an extension for your browser that plugs into your browser's developer tools and lets you take a look at the structure of Ember apps. And what's really cool about this is that you can use it to see how production apps are architected. So, for example, you know Vine, the website with like the 7-second videos of you punking your friends? If you log on to vine.co.co and you open up the Ember Inspector, boom, you can see all of the routes, you can see the models, you can see how the whole thing is architected. It's really cool. Another one is Bustle. Bustle.com. It's like a women's news website. And just yesterday I was talking with one of the guys there, and he was giving me this demo that he built of their backend, their CMS. And here's what's so cool about Bustle. The whole thing is just an API. It's just an API for reading stories and for posting stories. And if you visit bustle.com, it's just an Ember app talking to this API read-only. And then their CMS for their editors and their writers to use is just an Ember app, totally separate code base, so you're not conflating these two concerns, and it's just talking to the same API. And so, of course, when they roll out an iOS app, it's like, no problem. We already have an API ready to go because that's the API we needed to build our website.
That's honestly.
And if you navigate around Vine and Bustle, you feel how fast they are, right? Again, because you're not conferring with the supercomputer halfway across the planet to make a decision. The supercomputer in front of you is making a decision. So everything feels snappy. It's super interactive. And so to me, that's the advantage of a JavaScript framework. It's like, because everything is running on the client, it makes things that are possible with server rendering just so much easier that you actually do them. Like, you know, everything on screen is powered by JavaScript. So you can do things like say, well, you know, let's send an analytics event every time this component scrolls into view. You could do it with jQuery, but you're not going to do it for every section of the website. But you could, you know, in your Ember app say, okay, every component, every time it comes visible, send an analytics event. That kind of stuff becomes trivial.
That's nice. That's a That's a benefit right there. I totally am facing that kind of thing right now. Like, I wish I had better analytics on usage of things. And it's kind of like an overwhelming idea to think to have to kind of make a kind of a checklist, think of how every single thing works, go through it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting that – so in the Bustle's case, they'll probably never regret that architecture because – and it's not even that dependent on Ember really because it's really just how they did their data on the back end. So at some point if they wanted redesign, they could just do something else.
Yeah, there's nothing specific about Ember to this. It's just that Ember by far delivers the most complete, nice experience, right? Because so we do consulting in addition to building our product Skylight and doing the open source stuff. And – I can't tell you how many meetings I've seen where literally engineers for 2 weeks will argue about what build tools to use. And then once they decide between Broccoli, Grunt, or Gulp, then you'll have another 2 weeks of arguing about which CSS preprocessor to use. And then you'll have another week deciding whether to use dashes or underscores. Engineers are so good at wasting time over the stupidest decisions. And so having a – basically, you can – Sing of the day.
That's good.
You can – you know, you can change those if you want. But I feel like if as a community you decide, okay, guys, these are what we call trivial decisions. These don't matter. Let's just all pick one and go with it. It really, really, really doesn't matter in terms of productivity and delivering really great products to our users. So if you want to change them, you can. But you better have a darn good reason to change the conventions.
Well said.
I agree. I think that's what I like most about Rails is in that whole culture and framework is just they're saying, hey, don't reinvent the wheel like ever. And you may kind of have like a dependency hell if you like get into some weird gems or something. But it's more or less it's just like, hey, like let's not, I don't know, like. We know this whole suite of software, these conventions all work together. So we're going to present that in a package. And if you don't like it, you can do your own thing. But like you said, everyone just, the tendency of developers to just rethink things over and over and over and rebuild is pretty high, but for better or for worse.
Speaking of weird developer behavior, I'm curious if you've run into in consulting and stuff, if they don't like the fact that there is this such a thing called Ember Inspector, which reveals their entire application architecture.
You know, not really. And I've had like managers ask me about it on the internet and express some concern. And of course, there are ways of disabling it, but I think because web developers grew up in this culture of view source, where everything is kind of open and, you know, like I pilfer CSS techniques from other websites all the time, shamelessly. Sure. I'm like, oh, that was a cool effect. Let me go see how they did it. And for whatever reason, this has just become part of the culture of the web.
Yeah, you can't, you know, even just because you can see it doesn't mean you can do it. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And the code's all minified. I mean, people have been shipping minified code for forever. And
right.
I don't know, you know, you can decompile binaries and in practice, the kind of people who have the time to go reverse engineer your app are not the kind of people who are actually fielding a serious competitor. So it ends up not mattering.
Yeah. Never. I've never heard of an example where somebody's like, oh, they stole everything from me and now they're way bigger and I'm out of business. You know, that never happens.
Yeah. Although I do remember one time when I was working on the iCloud team, we accidentally did a deploy that deployed the non-minified version of the entire source code. And I don't think anyone ever noticed. Yeah. But it was big, man. That's, you know, that's like several megabytes of JavaScript.
Yeah, it's probably more of a performance concern than a legacy.
Yeah, I think we ended up catching it right away. But it was still a moment of panic because that was still when Steve was around and, you know, people were a lot more scared for their jobs.
Yeah, there's some... I don't know. That it's easy to flip a switch and have something like that happen. We did something at CodePen recently where we stopped gzipping like everything, and it took us like a week to catch it. Like, oh my god!
Yeah,
should be alerts for that kind of thing. Let me do a sponsor really quick. We have RWD Summit. That's the Responsive Web Design Summit. It's an online conference coming up March 10th through 12th from Environments for Humans. We asked you to send in a question and hashtag it rwdsummit.com. Very few of you did that, which, you know, I get it. Not everybody wants free tickets to free things, but I just feel like your chances of winning people are pretty decent if you just do it. We're going to do this for one more week, and then the next show that we do, which will be the first one of the new year, we're going to pick the ticket. So our hashtag RWD Summit. And you don't have to do it on Twitter. Just put that in the email when you send in a question from our form on our website so that I can search it and find your submission, essentially, about anything web design related. And if you want to make it about responsive web design, that's be nice, because that's what this conference is all about. It's one of their biggest summits. It's 3 full days. You can attend it from anywhere in the world. You know, you bring up a web browser and it shows you the speakers talking live from their house. And there's a chat room where y'all chat and all kinds of stuff going on. Both Dave and I will both be speaking at it. So that's a pretty hot reason to attend it, I would say. And use coupon code SHOPTALK for 20% off the ticket for it. Let's do another question. What do you got, Dave?
Ezekiel Mangalu writes in, "Hey guys, I've been thinking of learning a JavaScript framework. So far, I've been recommended to look into AngularJS and Ember.js. What's the advantages of using Ember to Angular in terms of scalability, security, and ease of implementation and maintainability?" Tom, softball?
Well, see,
is this a hard ball?
I don't know if that's a softball because let me explain the problem to you. Let me explain the problem. This is a question that we get a lot because Angular is obviously the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Mm-hmm. You know, like they have a full-time team of like 12 people at Google working on it. It's just me and Yehuda in a shack in Portland. That's not true. We actually have a very widely distributed team. So the problem is that it's hard to give an answer to that without comparing the trade-offs that both projects have made. And it's also hard to compare two things and their trade-offs without partisans of one side or the other feeling like it's an attack. So let me preface whatever I'm about to say.
This is the Ember.js official attack offensive position.
Let me preface this by saying that I think that Angular is a phenomenal project. I know the people who write it. I've met them personally. I think they're very awesome. I think they're very smart. And I think you could choose either one and probably be more or less be within the same ballpark of, well, you'll be within one or two orders of magnitude of happiness, depending on which one you pick.
This feels like the CSS preprocessor war kind of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of silly.
Like, at least you're doing something. But yeah, go on.
So I'll talk about two things. The first I'll talk about is technical, and then I'll talk about the social aspects also. So on a technical level, I think Angular is really great for sprinkling on top of server-rendered apps. So if you have a server-rendered app and you're writing a lot of jQuery and you're like, oh my gosh, this jQuery is turning into a big ball of spaghetti, I think Angular is a really great way of dealing with that. I think Ember's strengths are if you like the idea of having client-side routing, you want that really snappy routing, you have bought into the idea that separating your front end, your website being just a client of your API in the back end, I think is a great way to go. Now, to be fair, you can also use Ember for the same case of basically starting to move your existing server-rendered app over to this new architecture. And my buddy Brandon Hayes actually gave a really great talk about this at RailsConf. I think the talk was called something like Untangling the Ball of Mud, and it was about cleaning up your jQuery app to be an Ember app. So I think the problem with Angular is that it is much more flexible than Ember. It is dramatically, dramatically, dramatically less opinionated. And of course, everything I say here is going to be extremely biased, so you should gut check everything I say with friends who've had experience. But I spend a lot of time talking to other developers who are blunt with me, and they give me feedback about Ember where it's due. But the thing I've heard from them is that for people who have built big apps in both Ember and Angular, Angular tends to become very unwieldy at scale. So once you start adding more than a few developers, once you start adding a bunch of different pages, there's really no good routing solution in Angular, whereas Ember's router is everyone talks about Ember's router being basically the best in the industry. And I don't want to sound arrogant, but I think that's true. So the people I've talked to have said that because Ember is a much more opinionated framework, you can kind of get your team to align on those opinions and those conventions. And so it tends to scale out much, much better and much easier. And it's a lot easier to onboard new developers. Now with Angular, because it's so flexible and it leaves so much of the wiring up to you and the naming conventions, everything is on you. What I've been told by people who have written the big apps is it essentially becomes like big backbone apps, backbone similarly unopinionated, where you have your particular, your team's dialect of Angular, right? So you can't just hire someone who knows Angular and have them come in and be productive right away, because you have to decide on which router you're using and which data library you're using. And there's like conventions around how you name things that aren't enforced by the framework, they're enforced socially. My belief is that Ember is particularly well suited for larger teams, you know, more than like three or four people or people who have to coordinate together. So that's the technical aspect. There's a lot more to it, but, you know, I'll be here all day if I had to discuss all the technical trade-offs. But I think probably the most important thing is it's kind of like a social, or it's not a technical thing anyway. I don't know what the right word for it is. But my belief is that you should be using open source projects that align with your interests. So let me explain what that means. What I mean is, the people who are maintaining the project should be roughly aligned with the same goals, have the same goals as you do. So I learned this. There was a really great blog post, one by DHH, called Why There Is No Rails Inc. And he expounded on his philosophy here. And there was another really great one by, I forget who wrote it, but it was by one of the maintainers of Postgres, the database, around the time that MySQL was purchased by Oracle. And he basically made the case on why Postgres was protected from, I mean, I don't think Oracle has a really great reputation. They have a reputation as being somewhat predatory, right, in their business interests. And he made the case of, here is why Postgres will never be susceptible to a buyout by Oracle. And the reason is Postgres is maintained by this coalition of companies. There's no one company that dominates development. There's no real like full-time developer who's just like, my job is to make Postgres. Everyone is working at companies trying to solve problems using this tool. And that ends up being an extremely powerful force. So on the Ember core team, Yehuda and I, one of our very, very first goals was to rapidly diversify the team, which was, you know, we don't want just our company to control the project. And today, if Yehuda or I got hit by a bus, Ember would be completely fine, because we have a team of people who are regularly making contributions. Very few of them all work at the same company. They're spread across the globe. We have people in Lebanon. We have people in Australia. We have people everywhere across the United States contributing code. And they're all working at different companies, and they all have different needs. And the important thing here is, There's a tension in any technology between moving forward, advancing the state of the art, and maintaining backwards compatibility, right? So if you have a successful product, you can't stop and take 6 months to rewrite your product using the latest, hottest JavaScript framework, right? It's just not tenable. So I don't think anyone who is maintaining a JavaScript framework who had actual products themselves would be willing to say, okay, we're starting over with version 2 and we're going to break compatibility. It's going to be a ground up rewrite and it'll be out sometime in the next year.
It's like a not so subtle dig at what's going on in Angular.
Well, that's basically what's happening with Angular. And it's an interesting strategy. And maybe it'll pay off. It's a huge bet, and maybe it'll pay off. Maybe they will leapfrog us in terms of the feature set. But I feel like probably not, because while we have the tension of not being able to, or we have the constraint of not being able to throw away our products and rewrite them when version 2 comes out, we also have the constraint that we have competitors. And those competitors will be able to pick up Angular 2 in a year or two when it comes out. And they'll be able to take advantage of this hot new technology. So we have to strike the balance between moving forward and advancing the state of the art without forcing everyone to rewrite everything that they've already built. And so we call that stability without stagnation. And we have tried to put guards in place. I kind of think of open source projects as like an organism. And an organism has an immune system. And the best thing that you can do for the immune system of your project is to diversify as fast as you can. You know, and I think this also includes valuing contributors who are not just code writers. It includes valuing people who write documentation, valuing people who work on infrastructure, valuing people who run events and who organize meetups in the real world. So we're a very small grassroots project, but I think because of that, your interests tend to be better protected by using a project that it's not just a big group of people who are working full time. How do we build the best framework? Because those interests aren't necessarily aligned with yours.
I mean, even if Angular 2 does, you know, not to just, I'm just going to jump back to something specific here, I guess. There's some kind of loss of trust there, right? Even if Angular 2 is great and it does end up being rather successful, there's always some kind of fear that the same exact thing happens in Angular 3, right? You know, you're going to probably lose some.
Well, you know what's so funny to me is I said this like a year or two ago. I basically said, based on my experience at Apple, where I was working on Sprout Core full time, although I was kind of working on apps on the side, but basically full-time working on Sprout Core, I know what corporate open source is like. I know what it's like when you have a big team just chugging away. I've seen the pathologies that happen with this big corporate open source. And everyone accused me of spreading FUD. Everyone's like, oh, this is really unbecoming of you. You're just spreading FUD. You have no idea what's going to happen. So I just had to kind of laugh a little bit when the Angular 2 announcement was made. I felt a little bit vindicated. I know I shouldn't. I know that's small of me, but I felt a little bit vindicated.
There's a, you know, this might be, you know, correlation and not causation, but if you look at projects that really take backwards compatibility really seriously, they tend to be popular as far as I can tell. Something like WordPress has never deprecated an API as far as I know. They have tons of old code in there, but they're like, well, we're going to support it forever because we take backwards compatibility super, super seriously over a long period of time and look at where they are now. You know, you can make fun of them all you want, but they're absolutely not stagnant and huge.
Yeah, and I think this is the strategy. We've basically put in place processes to make sure that we cannot do a big bang rewrite. So, for example, we adopted a what we call a rapid release cycle. So every 6 weeks, just like Chrome, we cut a new release. And at the same time, we have a beta channel. So every 6 weeks, we cut a release and we cut a beta. The previous beta becomes a release. And what that means is that we can only build features that can be built in 6 weeks at a time, right? We can't actually do a Big Bang 2.0 release because we only have 6 weeks between the last 1X series and the 2.0. So the way that we decided to build the 2.0 feature set is to, we're actually taking all the features in 2, we're adding them to 1X. So basically, their features are going to start dripping out over the next 6 months. And then you'll be able to take advantage of them right away. And then you'll start getting deprecation warnings for older APIs so you can start fixing them up. And we're adding a tab to the Ember inspector that will just give you the file and line number of the deprecation where it came from. And so you can start, you can basically fix those in your own time, right? You'll have months to clear up all the deprecations. And then at some point when we do release the 2.0, I don't know if this has ever happened before. I don't know if this is novel or not, but our 2.0 will not have new features. It will only remove old features that we've deprecated. Right? So it's not a big bang rewrite. It's just we're slowly migrating the 1X branch to 2. Snow Ember. Yeah, there you go. So I think I think those are the processes that we put in place to make sure that we stay aligned. Our goal is, from talking to developers, we know that no one will ever get buy-in from their manager to rewrite their app. The only way that you can do an upgrade is if it's possible to do in a single sprint. So we've tried to make sure that all of the changes that we intend to land, anything that would break, you can take your, even large apps, one or two engineers should be able to complete that upgrade in a sprint.
Yeah, pretty neat. So there's literally processes in place. I thought of, when you brought it up at first, I thought of, you know, that little social network that was all the rage for like a week, Elo or whatever, and they had said, we're not going to have any advertising ever. And then people are like, yeah, right. And then like the next week, they're like, no, but really, look, We did like legal action to make sure that if we ever change our ways, that it, I don't know what it does. It screws up the company somehow or makes it impossible to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's important to put that in place so that people have, people can have that trust.
Real trust. Yeah. Cool.
And I think we have a track record. That's the other thing I'll say is I think we have a track record of delivering on the stability. I talked to Ember developers who've migrated from, you know, 1.2 all the way up to 1.9. And they're like, yeah, it took 30 minutes. That's our goal.
Very nice. There's some. I think we can't get out of here without talking about some of the newest stuff going on in Ember, which is there was a post on your site that was about the progressive enhancement kind of thing. I guess that's where I'm going with this. Kind of the clearly you have some opinions on it, but there was this is from now a couple of months ago when it was kind of like I think you were a little like not pleased with the site that like basically took, you know, had somebody who turned off JavaScript in browsers and then just like, took a bunch of screenshots of it and be like, look, these sites don't care about progressive enhancement. And you kind of say, look, you can't just chop the head off of a web browser and say,
that whole argument to me is just total horse pucky. And it's just,
thanks for keeping it PG.
It's just like, that really gets my blood boiling. The fact that, okay, the web is a platform, right? The web is a platform, and there's basically three major pillars that prop it up. There's HTML, there's CSS, and there's JavaScript. And for some reason, people decide that they're just going to disable JavaScript and decide that that is some arbitrary hoop that people have to jump through. Like, we need to disable this part of the platform that, by the way, no one actually does in practice. No one is, the vast, vast, vast majority of your users are not going around disabling JavaScript. Almost no one uses a browser that doesn't support JavaScript anymore.
But there's these classic phrases that are like, every JavaScript is always disabled before it's loaded.
You just don't get to say, like, you can't, like, no one's going around and being like, oh, look, if I get rid of these CSS3 selectors, the site breaks. No one's actually doing that. No one's like, ugh, CSS. You know what I mean? Like, no one's going around and being like, oh, well, this website should work without the video tag also. It's like, you can't, like, what is, pick a date or pick support matrix. But you don't just get to say this entire piece of technology that drives the entire frigging web is, we need to be able to rip it out and basically make your websites brain dead, and they should continue to operate fully functionally. Like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that you get to say, like, we're going to take away this piece and not, like, and no one's doing that for HTML and CSS. It's just ridiculous. So, thank you for getting me fired up this morning.
No, that's good. That's what I was hoping for. But it's true. But it's unfortunate that that's become like the moniker for progressive enhancement, and, right? When that's not really quite what progressive enhancement means.
And you know what really grinds my gears is that, you know, I feel like a lot of the people who are advocates of progressive enhancement, they're all very smart people and their hearts are absolutely in the right place. But I can't help but feel like there's a little bit of condescension coming, emanating from these arguments, right? Because developers aren't stupid. Developers aren't just, like, it's really condescending to say that developers are picking these JavaScript frameworks because, oh, they're just following the hype train. Oh, it's just the hype. And, you know, they're doing it just because they want to play with the new shiny. I've heard that argument before, and I think it's disgusting. People are trying to build awesome products. They have very limited time. They work at a startup. They have, you know, a few months of runway. They need to get an awesome product out that's going to get users quickly. And they're going to do whatever they need to do to get the best possible experience. And agree with it or disagree with it, people are making decisions that they think are best to build the best products for their company. And I have nothing but respect for that. Now, if you want to tell these people, well, actually, you shouldn't make your product as good as it can be because someone might disable JavaScript, I think that's just completely disconnected from reality. Like, your heart's in the right place, but it's just not pragmatic. So I believe in more of a real politics style of technology adoption, which is, if you want people to do something, make it so easy that they're like, of course I would do that, right? So all of the arguments that people make, I totally agree with. I agree that we should, if someone happens to be using a browser without JavaScript, like curl or some kind of SEO crawler, we should absolutely support that case. If someone is on a mobile device, high latency, I absolutely agree that they should see content before the JavaScript loads. 100% agree. But do all of those things trump the experiences that you can build with JavaScript? The marketplace has spoken and it says no. Now, this is the role, I think, of frameworks like Ember. Frameworks like Ember should be the ones pushing the envelope and making it so that people can deliver those really great experiences to a wider range of an audience as possible, including people without JavaScript, including people on slow connections on mobile devices. So that's what we're doing. And my argument against progressive enhancement has always been that it hinged on developers taking on so much complexity that it slowed them down and that it just it became totally untenable. But what if we could have the framework do it for you? If the framework can do it for you, then I think progressive enhancement, at least in the sense of having the initial view be rendered on the server, to me, that just makes a ton of sense. And actually, that's what I've been working on the last week, is we really want the ability for you to take your Ember app, deploy it, and be able to serve up the HTML first, and then once the JavaScript downloads, then it can take over, and then you still get all the advantages of the fast navigation and so on.
I think that's where this is the alignment. This is where everybody agrees, right? Of course, like the things that you were saying, you should get content before the JavaScript's loaded. It should be SEO friendly. It should be accessible in that kind of way, that it's not required. You know, JavaScript isn't required for absolutely everything that the website can do, or that I would get a blank page in those situations.
Well, it's funny you mentioned SEO friendly, because as soon as I tweeted about doing server rendering of Ember, a Google engineer DM'd me on Twitter and said, "You know that the Google bot crawls JavaScript now, right?" And actually, it's true. Like, we tested it, I think, like 3 or 4 months ago, whenever it was that Google announced this. They have a website where you can go on and you can plug in an app, and Ember apps work, and Angular apps and React apps work totally, totally fine with the Google crawler.
Right.
I think so. That's less of an issue now.
But they? You know, like they can say that they do, and there can be some proof here and there that you can look at. But is it always going to work as well as just some freaking HTML on a page? You know,
you don't know,
and we'll never be able to know. So it's an impossible argument to have.
In my experience, it has. But yeah, but there's other tangential benefits, like being able to curl it, for example, and see the output in a terminal is really nice and helpful, and scraping. Like, I think the web is built on this notion of scraping and remixing, and definitely it's a loss to not have that. So there's just a ton of good reasons to support it. Probably the biggest one is just speed. I remember sitting down for beers with Dan Webb, who is an engineer at Twitter. We were in Austin. I don't remember if it was South by Southwest or TXJS, but he had just given a talk about how Twitter had moved away from client-side rendering back to server-side rendering. And I really just thought he was being a bonehead, which is good. It's good that we sat down and had beers, because once he explained all the constraints they had, the decision made a huge amount of sense. So we argued for a couple hours over beers. but at the end of the day, we actually said, you know, I basically described this architecture that we're building now. And he said, "I think that if you guys build that, you've really got something there." And actually, we've been designing Ember's architecture around this long-term goal for a long time. It's just I've never personally had a need for it. And actually, Bustle is sponsoring us, Yehuda and I, to work on this feature. So I think especially for content sites, it's really important. When we started Ember, if you'd asked me, should I use Ember for something like Bustle or Vine? To be honest with you, I would have said no. It wasn't until I saw Bustle as a content site, just really freaking fast, that I was like, oh, I think there might be something here.
Mm-hmm. Something that we've talked about on the show a number of times is like, wouldn't that be nice if there was kind of like one router for both sides of an app, yep, and that it kind of worked on the server side, it worked on the front end. And it's exciting to know that we talked with Judd Schmidt last week, and he kind of works on a site that where that's the case. And now you guys are being sponsored to work on it and have kind of, So anyway, we can link up the issue where Ember is kind of moving towards this and stuff. I thought it would be interesting to ask you how that comes apart. Working on open source stuff that's sponsored, it's kind of a neat idea, isn't it?
Yeah, we were very lucky that Bustle was generous enough to do this. You know, we do consulting and we also have a product. So those are our two primary forms of revenue, mm-hmm, that we use to kind of basically subsidize our open source work. But in this case, you know, being able to really focus and spend a couple months just like really laser focused on this one feature that I think if we get this right, I think it's going to be pretty transformative. I think it's going to change the space a little bit.
Zaz, that same kind of idea, right? If the page is rendered with the server, all the links are just links, right? So Jed was explaining how they do it. It's kind of like, hopefully the JavaScript will kind of catch up as the page loads, and then it will just become an Ember app or whatever. But if it doesn't, you click it, you go to the next page, and it has another opportunity to catch up and do the stuff. You know, is that going to be how it's going to go?
Yeah, I think that's the idea. But I do want to make it clear, I think, you know, like any technical discussion, there's always ambiguity in the terminology. You know, like, what does reactive mean anymore? Like, you say the word reactive, no one has any idea what that means. I think it's the same thing with server-rendered apps. Some people have referred to them as isomorphic apps, which that term really rubs me the wrong way, but I guess I should just get used to it. Anyway, I think a lot of people think of server-rendered apps as this magic bullet or this panacea, or I don't know what the right word is, but people think, I'm going to write one app. It's going to be the client. It's going to be the server. It's going to be my toaster. It's going to be everything. And it just doesn't make any sense. And this is kind of the Meteor model. In Meteor, it's like, hey, guys, guess what? If you write your app in JavaScript, you can run it on the server and the client. It's like, whoa, yeah. But then the high fades, and you put down the joint, and you realize that these two apps have two wildly, wildly, wildly different responsibilities. The app running on the server is responsible for authorization, for authentication, for rendering like a JSON API, let's say. And the client has a responsibility of consuming that API and rendering a beautiful interface. So the idea that you can just jam these all into a single app that does everything is just like completely backwards. And if you look at any Meteor app, the Meteor app is basically like two apps wrapped in a conditional that says, if Meteor.isServer, do this. Otherwise, if isClient, run this other app. So that idea, I think, is absurd. And I want to make sure people don't think that they're going to be writing their server apps in Ember. The point is, you write your client, and then your server basically just takes over the process of booting up the session, doing the initial render, and then basically transferring the state of that client over to the browser. But still, at the end of the day, just the client app. All that's happening is that instead of it, the process starting on the client, it's starting on the server and then being handed off.
Lovely. So I don't know why I keep getting hung up on this idea, but is there truly like a routes file that can work in both places? Is it, because I think of how like large and like kind of complicated our routes file is at CodePen. And it's like, I don't know, if the client has to like know about all possible routes on this app and the backend does too, that seems like a nightmare to keep.
Well, but they're not the same.
They're just,
they're not the same, right? So I think in the right architecture, the server is purely serving up models. So like if I want to go to, visit the top users, if I want to go to css tricks/top users, there's not a top users endpoint on the back end. On the back end, there's just like a user's endpoint that I can query or filter. Right. So in my experience,
it does, unless you want the server to have this URL that it knows about so that it can serve a fully, you know, like this SEO work that you're doing. It needs to know about that URL still.
Ah, so that part would be handled by the Ember server side rendering. Right. So basically any URL that the client would hit, basically what happens is we have like a, you know, like a node app running on the production server, and it detects this request for /top users.
Right.
And then what it does is it boots up the Ember app. Well, I mean, it already has it running in memory, but it routes the Ember app to this URL. That Ember app goes and hits your API server, but presumably in the same data center or on the same machine even, goes and gets the data extremely quickly, renders out the HTML, and then returns it to the client. So even though it's basically you have the Ember app running on the server, you have your API server running on the server, and they're talking to each other, and then it's the Ember app that serves the HTML to the browser.
Even in this JavaScript off situation?
Even in the JavaScript off situation. So the Ember app, you know, like when you download an Ember app, it's running in your browser, but it's just running JavaScript. So what we can do is essentially have that JavaScript run on the server instead of on the browser, at least to get started.
I see.
And then everything is just links, as you said.
Okay. Pretty cool. Let me do a sponsor quick. We have lynda.com as a sponsor, lynda.com. Go to that /shop talk. That's the URL you want to go to if you want to sign up for the 10-day free trial. Otherwise, you can't. Otherwise, you go to sign up and you just got to cough up bucks, which of course you should because they have a huge library of learning material. But to get your 10 free days, go to /shop talk when you sign up. You know, there's just an incredible amount of courses in here, thousands and thousands of courses. And each of those courses is like, you know, up like 20 videos long and stuff. I know because I did one and I have a course on here about building in with WordPress. It's a couple years old now, but I knew when I was creating it that it was going to age. So I decided to make it kind of conceptual on how you build WordPress themes. So it's still relevant in there, kind of starting with a blank Photoshop canvas and breaking it into parts and building a kind of theme out of it. That's on there, but there's so much stuff. You can browse their popular courses. That's kind of a fun time to just look at, you know, what are the big ones that people care about a bunch. Of course, there's a bunch of WordPress stuff. And there's a new course on here about brainstorming, and there's stuff about running a business, and there's stuff about accounting and productivity. There's all this like tangential stuff for the stuff that we talk about too. Of course, there's tons of tech stuff, tons of design stuff, tons of software stuff. I wonder if there's an Ember course in here yet. I should look. I wouldn't. If there's not, I bet there's one coming really soon. Oh, there's a whole bunch of them. There's a, yeah. Well, anyway, there's like 8 courses or more on Ember. So.
I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah. Pretty cool. 10-day free trial /shop talk.
LYNDA.
We were talking about open source and contribution. And so actually we should do this one. We actually have one from, what's his name here? Remy, Supmeister writes in sup. So that's what.
That's my friend, Remy, I think. Remy Sharpe.
So, sup, he wants to know.
Sup was the question.
I have a request for Remy. Can we put some pressure on Remy right now? Is that okay? Can we put some pressure on Remy?
Yeah.
Some
social pressure is welcome. Okay. Listen, on Shop Talk Show.
Listen, Remy. My dude. We got to get some ES6 module support to JS Bin. Got to have it. Got to have some module action in there. Want to write my ES6 modules on JS Bin. Make it happen. This is my fault because he sent me an email asking me about my thoughts, and I never replied to it.
He has Tracer, Remy, right? We have Tracer on CodePen. He has Tracer in there, but that doesn't do modules.
Here's the problem. That's not the problem. Here's the problem. The problem is you need separate logical files. So JSBin has like CSS and then HTML. How about this? How about some friendly competition between CodePen and JSBin? See who can get ES6 modules first.
Well, you need a little file system is the idea.
Yeah, you just need a way to say, instead of having just a single JavaScript global scope where you have like a single file that gets evaluated, you need some way to say like, you know, I'm going to create a module named this, and I'm going to create a module named that, and then have some way of importing them.
Yeah, we're pretty close, and okay, I'm sure he has too, but there's like even some database work that kind of has to happen because we're hoping to get to the point where a pen, or in his case, a bin, but our case, a pen has arbitrary files attached to it. It's not just these three things that get smushed together kind of thing. It's kind of like you get your own little file system and you can do whatever you want in there. I cannot promise when we're going to get to that, but it's totally on our like queue or, you know, early next year list.
That would be amazing.
Cool. Let's see. Speaking of working on open source, Nick Herr writes in, one of the things I really enjoy about Ember is the community behind it and the support for getting started as a contributor. How did you get started in open source software? And what's the best advice you have for encouraging others to get started, particularly I think what Nick is referring to is here's like tangential people, like maybe not a core Ember contributor or a core Ember contributor, but not maybe not on the JavaScript side, like designers and writers, documentation kind of people. You know what I mean? So like, how did you get started? And then how would somebody else get started, particularly in a tangential way?
Well, I was extremely lucky. And I think it would be hard to try to reproduce. I don't actually know how it happened to me. It seems like a dream. But I was working at an Apple store. The Genius Bar.
Really?
Did you get hit on a lot?
Was that like an attractive?
No, unfortunately okay. not. I'm not as suave as you might think. Uh-huh. At least at the time. But I barely knew how to code. Like barely. I kind of like dabbled in it as a kid, tried to get my degree in CS, but the abstract math classes were way too hard. I was like, I'm getting a much easier degree than this. So so there I was post-college working at the Genius Bar, just swapping out iPods all day. Anyway, long story short, I had a buddy who'd gone up to Cupertino to work for retail. And he knew that I half knew how to program. Like, this is a thing that people knew. Like, I kind of knew how to write, like, shell scripts or whatever. So he was like, hey, we've got this project we're working on. We need a programmer. Unfortunately, we don't have official support for this. So do you want to come up? We'll still pay you what you're making at the Apple store. but you're going to be a programmer for us for however long it takes to ship this project. And I was like, you know, I'm so ready to get a retail man. I, like, whatever it takes, whatever it takes. So I got up there and they're like, okay, we're building the Sprout Core app. Building a Sprout Core app. And it's got an API that it talks to. And the API is in Rails. And I had, like, read the Rails book and I had, like, played around with it. So I was like, oh, well, let me do that. Because I don't know. The front end of Sprout Core is JavaScript. I'm like, well, I don't know JavaScript. And it doesn't seem like a language I want to learn. So we finished the API portion. So this is the thing about client-side JavaScript, by the way, is that your server becomes dramatically simpler, like so much simpler and smaller. Like the scope just reduces dramatically. So we finished the Rails API in like a week or two. And then they're like, okay, well, the Sprout Core app isn't even booting yet because no one knows JavaScript. So we're putting you on that. And I was like, well, I don't know JavaScript at all. And they were like, all right, well, figure it out. So I remember walking to the Barnes & Noble there in Campbell, California, at the Prune Yard. I remember walking to the Barnes & Noble and buying JavaScript, The Definitive Guide, and The Good Parts by Kroc. And I'm just holing up in my hotel room and just reading this book and stepping through the JavaScript app line by line, assuming at any moment I would be fired.
You're going to lose your $7.50 an hour, man.
I was like, yeah, this is going to be a disaster. I'm going to have to go back to fixing, entitled people's iPhones. But by the grace of deity, I survived and I somehow kind of struggled through JavaScript. And the next thing I know, this is the crazy thing. Next thing I know, Mobile Me, now iCloud, was using Sprout Core for all their front end apps. And I got to know the people maintaining it. And here's the thing. This was like 2009 or 2010. At the time, there was no one who knew how to write JavaScript like an app, right? Everyone was in this mindset of JavaScript is something that you sprinkle on top of server rendered stuff. It was like mind bending. People just could not get in the mindset of client side JavaScript. And even today, it's still hard. But 2010, man, like no one could think that way. They just were too enmeshed in it. But because I was so new and I had started writing JavaScript from this perspective, man, I was so lucky to be there at that time. And so they hired me to maintain Sprout Core. I had just learned JavaScript like 4 months before. And now Apple was hiring me to help them maintain their JavaScript framework. It was a trip, man. It was a total trip.
I don't even know anything about this Sprout Core. It's still a thing, apparently.
Yeah, not really. Okay. But it hobbles along. So then, by some miracle, Yehuda finished Rails 3 and he decided that he wanted to move on to the next thing. And he got this itch that he thought that the next big thing was going to be JavaScript on the client side, because that's where you can deliver really great interactions. I think he knew like the set of interactions you can deliver with server render stuff. There's a finite limit. So he started getting involved in client-side JavaScript, and he joined this company called Strobe with the guy who started Sprout Core, Charles Jolly, and he basically recruited me. He's like, I want you to, like, we had worked together a little bit designing APIs for Sprout Core, and so he basically poached me from Apple to go work on open source at this company, and that's how the two of us got started together, I'd been programming for, like, a year maybe, if that. And I get hired into this job at Strobe, and literally for the next, well, basically until today, every day of my life, I've gone in and pair programmed with Yehuda.
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, it's a trip, man. And so that's how I got started.
And then what if somebody wanted to start now, though? I mean, like, I have similarly good things that have happened to me throughout my life, but it's like, it's you almost feel bad about it sometimes because you're
Yeah, I feel terrible. Yeah, I feel like the luckiest guy in the world, no doubt.
I mean, there's around these parts, we often tell people just work on websites, you know, just build websites because it's kind of like you'll get there, you know, like just doing the work is the kind of thing. And but I don't know. Let me say this
for people that want to contribute is it can feel really demoralizing to work really hard on like a pull request. You submit it and it gets rejected, let's say, and maybe it's rejected with like a terse comment. Now, we try really hard not to do this, but in a big project, inevitably someone's having a bad day or they're running short on time. And inevitably, you don't treat people with as much care as you really would like to in a perfect world. The thing that I would say to people who want to contribute to open source is that by far the most important metric for us is consistency. So there are a lot of really talented people who will submit really awesome pull requests. But if we merge those pull requests, we are now responsible for that code that we didn't write. So we are very gun shy about adding new features or getting things in. And there's just a lot of signal to noise. There's a lot of bad pull requests. There's a lot of people who act in bad faith who just, you know, they just want to leech your free time to suit their ends, and they don't want to contribute back. So any open source maintainer over time becomes very protective of their time and their resources when the signal to noise ratio isn't great. So by far the best thing that you can do to become a contributor is to be consistent. And it doesn't have to be code. It can be if you have a design bent, you know, and you want to contribute design stuff. Documentation is so amazing. But the problem with documentation is if there's 1,000 different people writing it at different levels of skill, that voice in the written documentation sounds really disjointed. Which is why if you have spare time and you can say, like, it's more important for us to have 5 hours of your time every week than 40 hours of your time for 1 week, right? Or 80 for 2 weeks, right? Like, the consistency in the long term is by far the most important thing. We want to know that you're going to be around to help us maintain it, to help explain it to other people. If you're writing documentation, that you'll be there to take the pull requests that are good, but maybe the person is not a native English speaker, and help them improve it. That's by far the most important thing. And just the name recognition. If I see that you've been around for a long time, I'm going to trust you. Yehuda and I are both extremely aggressive about delegating before we feel comfortable delegating. You know, we've like, okay, we have this new repo. It's still kind of in the baby stages, but we're going to give you commit bid on it because you've been around for a long time and we trust you. And that trust really requires consistency, I think. So that's the biggest thing. Just be around. And yeah, I mean, maybe that's obvious, but sure. The consistency is the most important thing.
Pretty good.
That's like my toughest problem managing open source is somebody has an idea or they're like, oh, this doesn't do the thing I want it to do. So they spend like all weekend rage coding on it. And they're like, here, I fixed it for you. And you're like, whoa, hey, what? Okay. let's talk.
Yeah.
Like, that's how it always feels to me. It's like somebody just shows up at your house, like, I mowed your lawn, and you're like, whoa. Yeah. Hey,
so we actually have an RFC process, which you can check out, github.com/emberjs/RFCs with an S. And that's kind of a process that we have for incorporating feedback, just because we are, you know, we follow semantic versioning, we're post 1.0. We can't just be adding a ton of API willy-nilly. We really do need to think about it. And so we introduced a more formalized process for that we actually borrowed from the Rust programming language.
I'm going to say, Dave, you're very good at it.
So like a full request. Well, it's not my full-time job, so I'm attributing to the consistency issue as well. But like, you know, so it's like Thanksgiving and Christmas, I fix open source.
Yeah, but you know, you leave the things open, everybody gets an answer. You're good at being nice but saying no a lot. And you have an idea for what 2.0 is going to look like on a lot of your things. And so you're like, okay, maybe, but that's a 2.0 thing.
Yeah.
It's good.
Another big thing that people can do that I think is maybe surprising is just writing blog posts helps so much. Like, the barrier to entry for your own personal blog is so much lower than getting it into the official documentation, because the official documentation has to be maintained forever. But it's so helpful and so gratifying as an open source maintainer to see people pumping out like really great content about your open source library that, you know, it doesn't have to be maintained forever, but it's like, hey, I was trying to solve this problem and here's how I did it. That is so valuable, and a lot of times actually more valuable than the official docs. Because let's be honest, people it takes a certain special kind of person to sit down and pore through the docs from front to back. The vast majority of developers, and I'll include myself in this bucket, just Google the error message that they're getting.
Right. And there's no reason a link to that blog post can't be in the official docs with the right tone introducing the blog post kind of
thing. Right, exactly. Yeah. So by far the best thing that you can do. And that also just helps you get a name for yourself.
Alrighty then.
All right. Well, hey, we should probably wrap it up. Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show today. We really appreciate it. But if people aren't following you or giving you money, how can they do that? And then what's one big thing you'd like to plug before you go?
Sure. So follow me on Twitter. I'm the Big Red Phone Booth, Tom Dale. And if you would like to give me money, first, be a Rails developer. Second, be like, man, I wish my app was a little bit faster. Because we have an app called, or a service called Skylight, skylight.io, that will tell you how your Rails app is running and you can help you make it a lot faster.
Yeah, that's cool. Don't kill me for this, but it's kind of like New Relic for Rails, right? But like,
New Relic is just like, it's great for alerting. It monitors a lot of platforms. So like, you know, Node, Java, PHP, Rails, the whole bit. Mm-hmm. We're focused just on Rails. And so if you're a Rails developer, we give you a far, far better experience because we're focused on just that platform.
Sweet.
And our UI is really freaking killer. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial. You should try it out just to see how gorgeous the UI is. I'm pretty proud of it.
Nice. I might just do that. We have a Rails app, you know.
So Yehuda's involved in this?
Yes, Yehuda.
And that guy knows nothing about Rails.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool. Like, we built a product using all of these APIs that he and Carl put, who's my other co-founder who worked on Rails, put in Rails 3. So it's like one of these long games where they put the APIs in, you know, like 2 or 3 years ago, and now we're building a product on top of them.
Ah, the old long con.
Yeah, and the long con or the long troll. One thing that we just did that's pretty amazing. So we, not to get too much off on a tangent, but we wrote our agent in Rust, which is this really cool new programming language coming out of Mozilla. It's really powerful. And you should have someone on to talk about that. But because of that, we can do really low-level stuff. So we just rolled out a new feature that actually measures how many memory allocations are happening in production. So it's basically like having a memory profiler, but running in production 24 hours a day. And you can log it in any time and see what's allocating what amount of memory. It's really awesome.
It's priced right, too. You can be in the tens of millions of requests here for a couple $100, you know.
Like, yeah, the vast majority of our customers were significantly less expensive than New Relic.
Yeah. Right on. Well, thanks for coming on, Tom.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, everyone, for coming out and listening, coming into the live chat. We really appreciate it. Thank you for tuning in live. And this is the last episode of Season 3 of the Shop Talk Show. We will be back next year in January 2015 for Season 4 of the Shop Talk Show, which may feature a new website, but I don't know. May just get lazy over the holidays.
Well, and, we got to do it because there's the job board on it now. It's kind of got to get done. I'll help.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you got to go to shoptalkshow.com/jobs. We'll work on prettying it up and we'll see how far we can get there. Hopefully we'll have all that and it should be good. Thanks everyone. I'm going to give you fair warning. We're going to have to migrate all of our like feeds and everything. So we might be doing some really like gutty under like pinnings of the Shop Talk Show, and how we do the feed and everything like that. So, we just basically Shop Talk is too big and our MP3 host was like, hey, you have to move. And so now we have to move. But thanks everyone for listening. Cause that's like an awesome problem to have. So, we're going to be doing that in it. So if like 900 new episodes show up in your podcatcher, I'm super sorry. On that note, rate us up in your podcatcher of choice. We really appreciate it. And Chris, do you got anything else for us?
Oh, just shoptalkshow.com.